Are you talking to me?
Well, that's the sound of our show, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel with you over the next 2 hours. For some careful, I think clear, intelligent thinking and discussion about the critical issues of life. That would be ethics and values and religion. And of course, there's always a lot to talk about in those areas. We only get 2 hours a week, but we try to make the best use of those hours. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, my number, 1-800-227-5278. Lines wide open, 1-800-227-5278. The only rule is you got to give me a piece of your mind, all right? 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Just a reminder, April 30th is 1 week from last night. That is the night of the airing of the Faith Under Fire, a full-hour edition of my TV debate with Deepak Chopra. So please mark your calendar. Don't call our office about this, by the way. We don't know where in your local area or what channel in your local area this program will be aired on. You have to check your own local listings. You can go to the Faith Under Fire website. That might help. It's being aired on PAX TV across the nation. So go to the PAX TV website. Find out when Faith Under Fire is airing in your neighborhood and what time it is. We don't know. We don't follow those things, so don't call us. But be sure to check it out. And I've seen a clip of this. My staff has actually seen the whole thing, and they were very satisfied with it. We had an event a couple of weeks ago where we aired about 13 minutes of it, which I enjoyed. As I watched it, I was seeing it for the first time along with most of the audience. I have to admit, as I told them then, that it was a lot more fun watching it than it was doing it. I mean, it is a strange environment when you do these kinds of things. You are, and some of you don't realize how this all works out. To be in a crossfire circumstance is in itself a little bit daunting. Even for a professional like myself who has been in this, you never know what's up next. And so radio is one environment for that, and TV is another. TV is more difficult because not only do you have to worry about what you're thinking, you have to worry about how you're looking. That if you're looking grumpy, if you're looking devious, I mean, this doesn't play well, so you've got to be alert to that. It's even more difficult when you're in a TV environment and you're not just talking across the table with somebody else you can engage personally, but you're isolated in a studio, as I was, and each person on the show, Deepak Chopra was in Washington, D.C., I think, at that time, and Lee Strobel, who is the host of the show, was in another soundstage, and so I'm isolated. I'm in a big black room. It's actually a soundstage that's all black, with black curtains all around me, a cityscape behind me which I can't see. I'm perched upon a little stool, no notes, obviously, a plug in my ear so I can hear what's going on, and a big giant camera facing me in front. And just in very faintly, I can see the visage of Lee Strobel as the kind of behind the camera. Somehow they project this image, so I at least see someone, but I don't see the person I'm talking with. Now, when you watch this, you see Lee looking at a split screen, and it jumps back and forth between Dr. Chopra and I. That's your viewing. But there I'm sitting there kind of talking to this machine, this big eye, and trying to look engaging. The problem is, of course, when I concentrate, I just like little Annabeth, when she concentrates, she frowns or scowls or furrows her brow. I do as well, and then it looks like I'm a little bit angry. And now I'm not. I'm just trying to listen carefully and figure out what's going on and know how to jump in next. But I think that you'll, in spite of those liabilities and the frustrations that I face in that circumstance, I prepped pretty well, I think, and I also think you'll find that this is a good example of how to maneuver in these kinds of conversations. Now, one thing I want you to look for, there's a lot going on here, not only in terms of content, but in these kind of circumstances, ladies and gentlemen, when you're in a crossfire situation, and you're pressed for time, and people are watching, and you've got smaller segments to work with, and you have to work more with sound bites. Certainly, you have to know your material. You have to have an idea of what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go. And I had a game plan. I mentioned a couple of months ago what that was after I did the taping, but I'm not just thinking about the game plan. I'm trying to think about how I'm looking. And where I'm looking, you look up, you know, like you're trying to gather your thoughts, and you know how you look up to the right or to the left. Well, that looks shifty on the camera. You can't look up. You got to keep looking forward. So I'm trying not to look up, but I'm trying to look forward, and I'm trying to gather my thoughts, and I'm wondering about what I'm looking at, looking like. But the big problem here is just the tactical maneuvering. The content is important, but being able to put it properly and to be able to follow the dips and weaves of the conversation and all of the funky stuff that comes your way and the little shots that come your way. For example, at one time I was challenged. So you think people who don't believe like you are going to hell. That from Deepak Chopra, not from Elie Strobel. Now, of course, this is my belief, though rather crudely put. In fact, putting it that way, I think, is distorting of the nature of my belief. I'd want to put it differently so people had a better understanding. But when it's put to you like that on the camera, you're hard-pressed to do anything but say yes and then look like a fool. Well, I didn't say yes. I was able to maneuver around it a little bit. I want you to see how I did that. And especially want you to watch out for the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. Remember what that is. That's the move that is played against Christians, in which the non-believer calls the believer intolerant because the believer thinks that he's correct in his views. We Christians claim that Jesus is the only way of salvation, and therefore we are the bad guys. We are mean. And the minute we are called intolerant, note this, that the conversation has now shifted from the topic at hand, from the topic we should be discussing, to my personality. In this case, or yours if you're the Christian. Now they're attacking you. You're mean, basically, is what they're saying. And you need to see that, first off, that this is a shift in the discussion. Now they're attacking you. And the reason they're attacking you is you think that you're right. Now, the trick here is that if you realize this, you see the sleight of hand, you're not the only one in this discussion that thinks he's right. The other person in the discussion who's accusing you of intolerance for thinking you're right also thinks he's right. That's why he's arguing with you. He thinks you're wrong and he's right. But you're the only one who gets to get called a name, intolerant meanie. And so the ability to see this passive-aggressive tolerance trick puts you in a position, hopefully, to disarm it. And a lot of my time I spent with Dr. Chopra trying to point out that I wasn't the only one in the game with a point of view. I wasn't the only one in the game that was sounding dogmatic and sure of himself. That Dr. Chopra, in fact, sells millions of books, as he reminded me. Millions, not tens of thousands, millions. Turns out it was 20 million. You don't write 20 million books or sell 20 million books because you don't think you're right. You do it because you do think you're right. In fact, the book we were discussing was Peace is the Way. That's Dr. Chopra's new book, Peace is the Way. Sounds like he thinks he knows a few things. And anyway, that was at play there. I think what you'll see in that hour-long debate on Faith Under Fire coming up next Saturday, April 30th, is a lot of these things happening. And I hope that when you're watching, there's something you will learn. But I don't want that to be the only thing that comes out of the show. I hope you will learn some things about navigating in these. It's an educational experience. But I also hope that what happens is that millions of people who watch this show see something they haven't seen before in an intelligent representation of Christianity. And so I would ask you, if you're a follower of Christ, to please pray for next Saturday night, April 30th. On the West Coast, it's 10 o'clock at night, 10 to 11. Faith Under Fire on PAX TV, but wherever you're listening from, you'll have to check your own schedule to find out where PAX and when PAX is airing Faith Under Fire on April 30th in your market. Please, once again, don't call our office to ask us. We don't know. It just depends on where you live. Go to the PAX website to find the information, but I hope you tune in there. I just spent a very fun weekend in Ventura with a great group of people that always help me feel younger when I'm with them. And that is because in order to qualify to even be part of this group, you got to be something like 65 or 70 years old. I mean, these were old timers, and they were wonderful. Lake Avenue Church in Pasadena, a group of them had a retreat. I've spoken in their Sunday school before, and they asked me to come out, and we had about 100 of them, and it was just great. Not only do we have a bunch of great – oh, the enforcer says I'm an old-timer because I'll be 55 in another month or so. Yeah, I'm not – look, at I was the spring chicken out there. I was the spring chicken, all right? In fact, I felt like the kid lecturing the grown-ups, to be honest with you. And I mean that without rancor. These were people who were very mature in their faith, retired missionaries, retired pastors. It was a really sweet time, great attitude, and great worship, all old-time songs. My wife said, that one sounds like Fred Astaire. I mean, old-time stuff. But I like that stuff because there's good content and substance. And, of course, guess who the star was this weekend? It wasn't Mr. Kokel. It was Miss Kokel. That's little Annabeth Noel. She was such a hit. And what was great is there was a whole bunch of grandma types, not just grandma types, grandmas, that just wanted to cuddle and coo and pinch your cheeks and change your everything, took care of that. So we had some free time as all the grannies took care of the baby. And that was nice. We have a new pope. And I haven't talked to you since this happened, but this has been the talk of the town, Pope Benedict the 16th, formerly Cardinal Ratzinger. I know just a bit about Cardinal Ratzinger, and all that I know really is that he was one of the more conservative leaders in the Vatican, a right hand to the Pope, the past Pope. And someone asked me just recently, well, what do you think? Are you happy with this choice? And I said, well, yes, I am. As far as I know, these aren't the kinds of matters that I follow closely, and frankly, they're not the kinds of matters that anybody follows closely unless you're right in the midst of the Roman Catholic political scene, until something like this happens, and then everybody's talking about it. I was glad to see that this man was selected. Now, I've had my differences with Roman Catholic theology over the years, and I have been on the air talking about that. And this has caused some consternation over the years because some of my listeners are Roman Catholic. And the reason that I've raised issues is principally because of the kinds of things that were said by other Roman Catholic priests who represent the Archdiocese of Los Angeles in the media for the Roman Church. That is, I ran into conflict with them for things that they said they believed with regards to a number of different issues, and I'll touch on them in just a moment. And when I, as an evangelical Christian, stood or opposed them publicly on these issues in these forums, and with grace, these are interfaith discussions, Religion on the Line and Today's Religion on CBS TV years back. And so in these venues, I would oppose them, and that we'd get into kind of a theological fisticuff. I mean, it was a friendly debate, but we had opposite views. And I was quite stunned to hear what I was hearing from the priest, since I was raised in the Vatican I tradition of the Roman Catholic Church. And that tradition was, and very straightforward, if you're not Catholic, you're not going to heaven. I mean, that's what we were taught. And nobody can tell me otherwise. That's what I was taught. I went through that. That was the In fact, it was a mortal sin. It's the worst kind of offense to even go to a Protestant church. Now, that all changed in Vatican II, and some would say, well, it didn't really change, and maybe I'll talk about that in a moment. The point was, I was so surprised at how things had changed when I was confronting these priests in the media that I was almost flabbergasted to hear what they had to say. And this stimulated some conversation, of course, on the air, and also stimulated some angry calls from Roman Catholics. And my response to them was, and I think there's even a piece on the website called An Open Letter or a Clarification on Catholicism, don't be mad at me because I'm saying this is what Rome is saying. If you don't like it, be mad at Rome. Be mad at your priests. They're proud of this. They're championing this. They're parading this new doctrine, this new openness. And you know, don't be mad at me. So over the years, I've been in a position to voice some concerns here, but let me just say at the outset here, with regards to this pope, I'm glad that Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict the 16th because he's a conservative. Now, he may have views theologically different than mine, and we can talk about those maybe later. But the reason that I'm in favor of this new religious leader taking the helm is because he shares an epistemology with me that I think is vital. In fact, in one of his, if not his first homily, either after becoming a pope or his last homily before he became a pope, he talked about the problem that he described as, and this is a phrase now that has been coined and you hear it bandied about quite a bit, the dictatorship of relativism. This pope is deeply concerned about relativism. Outside of the church, inside of the church, wherever, worldwide, this is eating away at the foundations of the faith. Now, Dr. Frank Beckwith, who is my co-author on our book, Relativism, just emailed me the other day and said, our book sales have shot up on Amazon.com. Wonder why? I mean, that's a mystery to me. We haven't been doing oversales at Standard Reason. We just got a steady run of sales here on the relativism book. But here is the new pope talking about the problem, and anybody who does a search on the issue, especially looking for titles, is going to find ours, because our book is entitled Relativism. Pretty straightforward. Feet firmly planted in midair. And so I'm with him on this. He shares my epistemology. We have a foundational understanding about how the knowledge project works. And so when there are differences of opinion about things between myself as an evangelical and Pope Benedict XVI as a Roman Catholic, at least we've got the same game rules to operate from largely to have our conversations. It's a lot harder to have a conversation with a relativist because you don't even have the same set of rules, or at least it doesn't appear that you have that. And so I'm in favor of this this pope, and I think he's going to be good if he continues in the kind of conservative direction that his past has indicated he will continue in, and I hope that he does. I do have some concerns about the issue of inclusivism, and I will get to that when I return from this break. And then I'll get to your calls. My number is 1-800-227-5278. Lines open there. And if you're in the 714 area code, dial me locally at 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason. I'm waiting to hear from you. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise? It's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Now And you're listening to Christianity Worth Thinking About here on Stand to Reason. Greg Coakley, your host, with you every Sunday, 3 to 5. And glad to be here. If you're listening on the World Wide Web and you'd like to call in sometime, you're welcome to do that. Of course, when you listen on the web, you can listen anytime you want. We have about 6 or 7 months of a backlog of radio shows always posted on the web. You can go to str.org and listen to any shows that you've missed. And if you're outside of our footprint, that's the only way to get our shows. But you can participate in the program just by calling us, 1-800, make that 1-800-227-5278. During show times, which is 3 to 5 on Sundays in Los Angeles. So make the time calculations and give us a call, and you're welcome to join our live program. Talking just a bit about the new Pope, I had reminded you, by the way, and I'm going to try to do this every segment, that coming up next Saturday night is the airing of PAX TV's Faith Under Fire with Lee Strobel and my one-hour-long TV debate with Deepak Chopra. So that's coming up next Saturday night in your area. Find out what time PAX is airing that and watch it if you'd like. I think you'll enjoy it and get some things out of it. But talking about the new Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th, and I'm happy with the choice. I don't go deep in these matters, I'll tell you that. But as far as I know, this man's a conservative. He's certainly conservative on the critical issues that I care about, and he is very concerned about the issue of relativism. He talks about the dictatorship of relativism, deep concern of his. The more he can talk about that, the better, as far as I'm concerned. But there is a concern that I've had, and I'm not sure where Pope Benedict stands on this issue. I understand that he has been largely in favor of the reforms of Vatican II in the mid-60s, and apparently of late, though, he has had some misgivings. Now, this strikes me as odd, by the way, and maybe somebody who's Roman Catholic can explain this to me, but I don't know how, given the Roman Catholic authority claim that the Church speaks, the Roman Catholic Church speaks with the authority of God when speaking in terms of dogma, through holy tradition, the teaching magisterium of the Church, and when the Pope speaks from the chair, which doesn't happen very often, but when he makes a declaration ex cathedra, then this can't be an error. It's an infallible declaration. Well, it seems to me when the councils get together, this is the teaching magisterium, and when they make their statements about dogma and doctrine and the way things are, that these are statements that have an infallible role in the doctrine of the Church. And if that's the case, then how is it that the Pope now has mixed feelings about that? He's uncertain about that. It either was and is the Word of God, in a certain sense, spoken through the Roman Catholic Church, or it isn't. If it wasn't then, it isn't now. If it was then, it is now. It's not the kind of thing that you can kind of agree with for a while and then disagree with if you hold, it seems to me, to the Roman Catholic authority claim. So that raises some questions. But I've been concerned with Vatican II. And the reason I'm concerned is when I started doing interfaith dialogues on the radio, in forums that include a Roman Catholic priest, I was stunned to discover, me being a former Catholic of the Vatican I tradition, having been taught that it's a mortal sin to go to another church, even a Protestant church, having been taught that only Roman Catholics are going to heaven, to then learn that that Roman Catholicism had softened quite a bit on this issue and had become inclusivistic in their views. Now, this isn't pluralism, where all religions on their own merits lead equally to God. But it's something like that in its effect. Inclusivism says there's only one way to God, and that one way is Jesus Christ. But you don't need to know Jesus to benefit from the work of the cross. You need Jesus in God's bookkeeping, as it were, but you don't need to know him personally. And this Vatican II made it clear, if you are separated from the gospel through no fault of your own, and you are doing your best to sincerely follow God as you know how, then the grace of God is manifest to you, and the blood of Christ is made available to you. Well, that's pretty straightforward out of Vatican II. Here's the problem. In application, this means that we don't preach the gospel to the Jews anymore. We don't preach the gospel to the Hindus or to the Muslims. They already have their relationship with God such as it is. And it may not be quite as pure as our more accurate understanding from the Roman Catholic perspective, but it still is a bona fide relationship with God. In fact, Mother Teresa was purported to have said, it's not my job to make Hindus into Christians, even Roman Catholic ones. It's my job to help Hindus be better Hindus. Now, this is quite a stunner, especially since Jesus gave the Great Commission to go into all the nation and make disciples of all the world to make disciples of all nations. Why would we do that if these nations already have a relationship with God? If Hinduism is, at its core, idolatrous, and I don't mean that metaphorically, I mean that literally, actually, they worship idols. I've been to India. I've lived in Thailand. Buddhists there, but the same kind of thing. Idols everywhere. And if the first commandment is, I am the Lord your God, you shall not have any other gods before me, that we are not to worship idols, then to say that it's our job to help Hindus become better Hindus means that it's our job to help Hindus become better violators of the first commandment. That's crazy. This viewpoint also presumes that there is such a thing as somebody who is isolated completely from the message. It seems to me that Paul's statement in Romans 1, that nobody essentially is isolated from the message, applies here. And that since nobody's isolated from some information about God, then nobody is without excuse. They are without excuse, he says it twice in that passage. So when Vatican II says, for those who through no fault of their own are isolated from the message, seems to me Paul's statements make it clear that that kind of thing can't apply. In any event, the upshot here, and this is my concern, and then I can get to calls in just a moment. 1-800-227-5278, by the way. The concern is, if somebody is promoting the idea that one can get to God through Christ by the means of his own religion other than Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. It doesn't seem to me to make sense in light of what Paul says in Romans 1, 2, and 3, and 4. It doesn't make sense in light of the Great Commission. It doesn't make sense in light of what the apostles themselves said to people who already had a religion that they were following sincerely. Paul himself said, I bear them witness, the Jews, that they have a zeal for God. But it's not in accordance with knowledge. They've got it wrong, and getting it wrong matters, Paul said. It's in Romans, first couple verses of Romans 9 or maybe Romans 10. So it's possible to be deceived on this, the scripture says, but it doesn't seem to me how it's possible to be deceived in that way on this doctrine, and therefore this doctrine, this inclusivistic doctrine that comes out of Vatican II, must be mistaken. Here's a more insidious problem. What if it is? If it is mistaken, that means there's a whole lot of people who've been given false hope by Christians that everything's just fine, hunky-dory, peachy-keen, you're covered by the blood of Christ even though you don't realize it, you're kind of an unconscious Christian, see in heaven, when in fact they'll never make it to heaven because they will stand before God to be judged on their own life. And they will not be judged by their sincerity, but rather by their conduct. And the standard is the law, and the law demands perfection. And everybody that falls short of that, unless they have the defender, the advocate, Jesus himself, they will be punished for their own crimes. I mean, that's pretty straightforward in the scriptures. Now, what if I'm wrong? What if God's mercy is wider than I think it is? I think it's pretty wide, by the way, but some would say, oh, you have a narrow view of God's mercy. All right, well, maybe I'm wrong. What if I'm preaching my message and I'm wrong? All that follows from that is there are going to be a whole lot more people in heaven than I thought there were going to be. I would much rather be in a position of discovering that there's a whole lot more people in heaven than I thought than be in a position to discover there's a whole lot more people in hell. that I thought. And the miscommunication of the message that I offered may have been one of the reasons they're there, after a fashion. This is one thing I don't want to be messing up on. And so what I try to do is I try to communicate the same message that Jesus and the men he trained communicated in a word, Acts 4:12, there is salvation in none other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. And this, spoken by the Apostle Peter to a group of very religious men, the Sanhedrin of the Pharisees and Sadducees, the leadership of the Jews. These guys had a religion. They were very zealous. But Peter still said, it's not enough. Hey, remember later on in the book of Acts where you have Cornelius? He's the Gentile guy who is a God-fearer. He was following God. God even gave him a pat on the back, but that wasn't enough. He still needed the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is why God gave the vision to Peter, sent Peter over to talk to Cornelius and give him the truth so he can get what he needed to actually be saved. Being a God-fearer wasn't enough. So it is a question, and we'll see what Pope Benedict the 16th ultimately says about the nature of the gospel. Are the Jews safe right where they're at? Are the Muslims safe right where they're at? Are the Buddhists and the Hindus and all others who are sincerely following their own religion? Does the blood of Christ apply to them? Or is it rather the case that there is salvation in none other but Jesus, and that there aren't any unconscious Christians in that regard, that people are saved by Jesus even though they think they're saved by Buddha or Muhammad or Krishna? We'll see what happens with Pope Benedict the 16th. I'm anxiously awaiting that. Okay, time to go to calls here? Yeah, we can do that. Let's talk with Stephen in Laguna here in Southern California. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, thanks for taking the call, sir.
Sure.
I was really impressed listening to you. I'm actually walking using my cell phone.
Uh-huh.
I'm Persian by culture, and I read Bible several times.
You said you're Persian?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And now they call them Iran.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. Well, whatever the case is, the Muslim faith. So I look at the whole religion, all the religions, from helicopter view, look at all of that. And
okay.
I was looking, trying to see what First Peter 3:15 really meant to this whole conversation, that in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks.
Right.
The reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect.
Sure.
Maybe Mother Teresa's intention is, if she becomes a good example, those Buddhists or Muslims, anybody sees, hey, I want to have her what she has. This is where First Peter 3:15 comes in. A lot of time people want to force their religion, their belief. If you believe in Jesus, you read this thing, you confess your sin, you're a Christian, then you obey me and follow through. Maybe that's the way it should be. I don't know.
Well, you know, let me jump in here and offer an observation, Stephen, because I other people have made this observation to me about First Peter, that what Peter's saying is that you give an answer only when asked, all right?
Exactly.
And he is referring to, he says, be ready to give an answer when you're asked. But does this mean that we only speak when we're asked,
exactly,
like we're living the way we're supposed to live? And I have to ask myself the question, what was Peter's example? Peter was the one who gave this word. What did Peter do? Did Peter just go about fishing and waited for somebody to say, you know, you're just a pretty nice guy by the nets. Can you tell us a little bit about your religious view? And then maybe we'll believe that too. The answer is no. Peter went out to preach the gospel, and he got himself killed in the process. The same thing with Paul, and the same
example,
thing with...
Example, though.
Pardon me?
Jesus says, take up my cross and follow me, and he did exactly that. He did it. He said, Peter also said, love in action, not by words. Love is really giving self up, and he did exactly that.
Who are you speaking to? Wait, who are you speaking about?
I'm talking about...
Peter, right then?
Peter also gave himself up.
But Peter... Peter didn't just stay a fisherman and just love people. He went out and he communicated a message. Now, loving people and being gracious to people and kind to people and having all of those virtues are an important part of the message, but they aren't the message. The message must...
I agree with you on that.
Pardon me?
I agree with you
100%.
What I am saying is, I don't know if I could say Mother Teresa what she did. I'm not a Catholic, by the way. I'm just trying to observe.
Right.
I don't even know how I have any religion anymore because Christianity, I really someday want to follow the footsteps of Christ. I think it's a wonderful thing he did. A good example. I think it would be the only way you can really bring peace to the world.
Well, Stephen, Jesus, actually, when you read
to get there, I think we need to reach out to everybody out there to converse. You see, if you're a Muslim, you're a Buddhist, it'll be easier for me to come have a conversation.
Okay. I'm with you on that, and this is part of what we teach at Stand to Reason, teaching people how to communicate.
They have a terrible way of converting. You see, God knows in the heart of people. He is the one. He knows how we feel, how we go about everything. I think if we approach people, let them give them comfort where they are, then they see the love. What you do, they really want to be what you have, to have what you have, was 1 Peter 3:15. So then they'll ask you that question. How did you get there, Craig?
Okay, let me try to answer this, Steve. And I guess I could say I agree with you as far as you go. Here's my concern about what you're saying, though.
Go ahead.
And what it seems like you're saying is that if you just, and I think I'm using your words here, follow Jesus, and I'm going to put that in quotes for just a moment because I want to refer back to that in a second. If you just follow Jesus, which you understand to be loving and kind and whatever, then people will see your manner of life and want what you have. Now, certainly, I think that's part of the package. But following Jesus doesn't just mean being nice to the poor and kind to people. It means doing the kinds of things that Jesus did. And what Jesus did is he didn't just love people. He also spoke the truth to them in such a way that in many times people were deeply offended. In fact, Jesus got himself crucified. Let me finish the thought, Stephen, and I'll let you back in. Not for the kind things that he did, but because of the forceful things that he said regarding the truth. So point I'm making is we are to be have the character of Christ and speak the message of Christ, and some people are going to be converted and some people are going to get mad and throw stones at you, you know, and both are part of the message. And what I'm resistant to do is thinking, well, we can't say the kinds of things that would get people upset because that's not really loving them. And I want to point, just as you have done, to the example of Jesus in this regard. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Actually, I don't disagree with you that you have to go share what's out there, what you've experienced, and share everything. But I don't think you have a job to tell them that if you don't convert right now, you're going to go to hell. See, we don't know. God knows the heart of people. It's in the Bible.
Stephen, have you studied the New Testament?
Yes, I did.
Have you studied the way the disciples shared the gospel in the book of Acts? Because there we have the historical section of those people who communicated the gospel to people, the ones that were actually trained by Jesus themselves. Have you studied that?
If you say several verses, which one I may be able to.
Okay, well, actually, I went through the text and I look at all 13 times that the gospel message was preached. And the fact is, every single time, they did that very thing. They warned people about God's judgment without Christ. That was exactly what the disciples did in every single time in the book of Acts.
What does that mean if you don't have Christ?
I'm using it as a – right. We could talk. I'm using it as kind of a short phrase here to describe putting one's confidence or trust in Christ, that he died in behalf of them. And I could spend more time to explain it. But I think that's important to do, by the way, when we're talking with other people. I thought we were both kind of – I'm using a shorthand with you because I think you understand some of these things.
I agree with you.
Okay.
Actually, what I'm saying is if people – anywhere in the world, they love Christ. They do. They love what he does. They really want to do what he does. They're still born in that culture, and they're there. And I don't think deep down we know they really care about that statue in that place. Once they see it, Greg, they're talking about it. They have a question with it. But they're concerned about their family, their tie, a lot of issues that you don't even know about.
Yeah, well, that right.
To ask a Jew. Tell them, I bet you a lot of Jews, they really love Jesus. They're scared to lose all of their family. They think they haven't grown to that level as Greg is, right?
Okay, well, that might be the case. But when you're talking about individuals, and I'm going to have to go right now because I got a break, but just the last thought here. When you're talking about individuals, I don't know their hearts. Only God knows their hearts. But that doesn't mean that I'm not in a position to say something about the message that needs to be preached to them. God knows their hearts, but he's given us the message that needs to be communicated. And if they're following a false religion, then they're in trouble, and they need to be and it is our job to help them to see what Jesus said about the truth of that and then protect them. Hopefully they'll believe and be protected from the wrath that is to come. This, by the way, a phrase from the book of Acts and one of the preachments of the Gospels by one of the apostles. So maybe we agree on more than we disagree on. In any event, Stephen, it was a great talking to you, and I appreciate your call. Greg Kogel with more to come here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kogel, Stand to Reason, Christianity Worth Thinking About, and I'm here to give you a piece of my mind, as I do every Sunday, 3 to 5. Saturday night, next, April 30th, Faith Under Fire, PAX TV, Lee Strobel, Deepak Chopra, and Greg Kogel, yours truly, and I hope you listen in. Check your listings on PAX TV when it airs in your neighborhood, but it will be Saturday evening, April 30th, sometime on some channel. In your community. And 1 hour long there of interaction with Dr. Chopra, I think you'll find it interesting. And is this Travis in Baltimore?
This is. Hey,
welcome.
Greg.
Hi, Travis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
I'm sure.
Your ministry. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir.
I'm a new Christian. I'm 19 years old. I go to school in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what kind of brought me to Christian theism, I guess, was C.S. Lewis a lot, but also more evidential apologetics of J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I've been kind of reading quite a bit and listening to just some online material of presuppositional apologetics
right.
work, and I was interested in...
Who are you reading, Greg Bonson or John Frame or Van Til?
Bonson, mostly.
Okay. Very bright guy. He'd been on our show a number of times before he went to be with the Lord, so...
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for Greg Bonson.
Definitely, and I...
Or I should say had a lot of respect for him.
Had a lot.
Yeah.
His debate, I know, with Gordon Stein was just remarkable, too.
Yeah, Stein the atheist, he's a believer now, you know that? Gordon Stein?
Really?
Yeah, he's dead.
Huh.
That's gallows humor, you know, never mind.
Yeah,
he's on. Some people say he's on fire for Christ. I would never say something like that. I think it's a bad taste. But anyway, cool.
Yeah, that's rough.
Okay, so you're impressed by Greg, and he's a bright guy, and he's a presuppositionalist. And for those who are unfamiliar with the language here, there are different philosophies about what is the most accurate or God-honoring way about doing the task of defending the faith. And there is evidentialism, which basically we give evidence. I mean, very simply put, we give evidences, and people then in assessing the evidences, God uses them to bring them and persuade them into the faith. And examples of evidentialist apologetics, apologists would be J.P. Moreland or William Lane Craig or R.C. Sproul would be more of a classical apologist, and yours truly. So, but there is another line of thinking on this, and Cornelius Van Til, John Frame, Greg Bahnsen, writing in the area of presuppositional apologetics, says that the most honorable way to do apologetics biblically is to take not the evidential approach, but the presuppositional approach. And this is something that you've been studying. So what is your understanding of what presuppositional approach is?
Well, from what I gather,
Francis Schaeffer, by the way, would be roughly in that camp, although he was kind of had a foot in both worlds.
Right.
Dr. Schaeffer was actually mentored by Cornelius Van Til, as I understand it.
Uh-huh.
So what would be your understanding of what presuppositional apologetics entailed?
Well, from what I understand, and again, my knowledge is limited,
mm-hmm.
but from what I understand, it basically goes into detail about how classical or more evidential apologetics fails because in order for them to work, you have to presuppose triune gods, and essentially any kind of truth claim is based on these presuppositions, and these apologists would say that without first assuming the triune God, you couldn't proceed to prove anything because the existence of abstract universals is impossible in, say, a naturalistic universe.
Right, right. Okay, this is their standard argument. You're right so far on this. Their standard argument is called the transcendental argument.
Uh-huh.
And they say without the existence of God, there would be no ability to reason. There would be no – the preconditions for – rationality or the ability to reason is the existence of God. And they argue that way. In other words, before the process of knowing could get off the ground, there would have to be a God that secures the whole process. Okay? And I think that's good thinking. But let me ask you a question. When you were 8 years old, did you know anything?
I did know some things.
Okay, you did know some things. Did you happen to know that God was the grounding for all rationality?
No.
So you can know things without knowing that God is the one who makes knowing possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference between the epistemological issue of knowing and the metaphysical issue of how knowledge works.
Right.
That there must be this grounding. Because of the distinction that we just identified, I think the presuppositional approach as an overall view of the right way to do it fails. Because even though they're right, I think, in the idea that you have to have God as the grounding of knowledge, just like you need God as a grounding of morality, you don't have to know that you need the grounding to know things or
right.
to believe in right and wrong, for that matter. You have a hard time making sense out of the process of knowledge or the sense out of morality, but you certainly can know things and you certainly could know right and wrong even though you don't know how you know them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what they end up doing with their transcendental argument is just offering another evidential argument for the
exactly.
existence.
That's a lot of the confusion that I've gotten into because it seems to me that a lot of times presuppositionalists are almost hostile to more traditional arguments, and I don't understand how they're in.
Well, the reason that they're hostile, every one of the presuppositionalists is a Calvinist.
Uh-huh.
Okay, every single one of them, and this is because presuppositionalism finds its home in a Calvinistic worldview, which focuses on the sovereignty of God. Now, I think that's great because I'm a Calvinist. But when it comes to the issue of – they say, look, if God is sovereign in salvation, he's first in sovereignty and salvation, then he should be first in our apologetics. And what they mean is we should start with him.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't start with where people are at and move towards God. We should start with God and show that he's the only logical starting point. Well, there's nothing wrong with that as a technique. And I think it can be used, and it can be used effectively. The problem is when those who are doing that say this is the only God-honoring way to do it, because I don't think Paul did that, and I don't think Jesus did that, and I don't think the other apostles did that.
Right.
I think they argued in a number of different ways, and I think a sensitivity to presuppositions is important, and this is one of the contributions that Dr. Schaeffer made to the discussion and had a great influence on my own life. But I don't think the presuppositions are ultimate in the way that the presuppositionalists say. And it certainly is possible for people to know things even though they don't know why they know them. And they haven't been logically consistent. And so and that's why I think you can work with people then without having to get into this heavy-duty philosophical ontological grounding of knowledge business before you can get off in the apologetic task of defending the faith.
So essentially you think that transcendental arguments are philosophically sound, but as an apologetic method, evidential appeals are probably more
compelling.
More compelling.
I actually think that the transcendental argument is a kind of evidential argument.
Uh-huh.
It's an attempt to get people to look at the way the universe is and to see what is the best conclusion that follows from the way the universe is. If the universe is a rational universe, then it seems most intelligent. The best answer, the best explanation for a rational universe is a rational God. The best explanation for a moral universe is a moral God, that kind of thing. But to me, that's an evidence. That's a reason why people ought to believe in our view.
Right.
It doesn't guarantee they will believe, and there are other evidences that you can offer. So I just see this as a good line of argument for certain people, but I don't think they succeed in establishing this methodology as the only appropriate way of defending the faith, and therefore then they write books against guys like me and JP and Bill Craig and R.C. Sproul and others who are using what might be called an evidentialist or classical approach to defending the faith as if we're doing something amiss.
Right.
We're wasting our time. We're spinning our wheels. It doesn't seem to me like I'm spinning my wheels. I see God using this all over the place, in spite of me, many cases, but he's still using this. And anyway, so that's my take on this. I don't usually talk too much about the debate between presuppositional apologetics and evidential, Travis, because as I've said in the past, it's hard to characterize the different distinctions. I mean, they're kind of refined, and a lot of people just aren't interested in that. But those who are interested are really interested, and they want to know what's going on. But when I get down to it and I do the final assessment, and I've done quite a bit of reading and thinking on this issue, my response is I think it's a tempest in a teapot for the most part. It's just it's a lot of talk about things that don't ultimately get you anywhere. Now, I can say that because I'm an evidentialist. You know from your reading that a presuppositionalist would never say such a thing.
Right.
Because to them it really matters. It's the core of everything, and this is the only approach that really does justice to God, that honors Him properly. I just don't think that's true, you know. And that's why, look at my view is, I'll use a lot of different kinds of arguments. I'll use evidences. I'll use an inference to the best explanation. I'll use inductive or abductive or deductive. I'll use presuppositional arguments, like Francis Schaeffer did. Pardon me?
Anything that'll is pragmatic in a way that will win someone to Christ.
Yeah, any legitimate way that will win them. And I think all of these are legitimate ways, and I think we see examples of some of these in the scriptures, and there's no problem with it, it seems to me. Let's just do our best to try to show the reasonableness of Christianity and let the Holy Spirit work in the process to draw people to Himself.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that sound to you?
That sounds good, and that clarifies a lot. I always found transcendental arguments really compelling,
mm-hmm.
especially like Plantinga, for instance, has an evolutionary argument against naturalism.
Yeah.
And that always seemed kind of transcendental to me.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis. And
yeah, Plantinga's argument, you said. Yeah, I think you're right. That is, if evolution is true, how could you know anything?
Right.
Why would we trust our senses to give us true knowledge about things?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that's similar. That's in the same ballpark. And when Bahnsen uses that argument, I think that's good. And in fact, you know, I've written a book on relativism with Frank Beckwith, and pardon me?
I've read it, actually.
Good. Well, we close with an argument for a moral argument for the existence of God. And I think that's a kind of transcendental argument in the sense that instead of asking what are the preconditions for rationality, which would be the standard transcendental argument, I say what is that we ask what are the preconditions for morality?
Right.
Given the failure of relativism when looked at closely, if relativism is false, then some form of moral objectivism is true. Some form of moral realism is true. We have real morality. Well, what kind of worldview best explains this world that we've discovered, a world that is thick with morality. It's so thick with it, by the way, we can't, even when we deny objective morality, we keep using moral terms in our language because it, like, deep down inside we know better. And it seems to me that the best explanation for these things is the existence of a God that grounds morality in the same way that God would ground or account for rationality in the standard transcendental argument. The point here is, Travis, I believe in these arguments. I think they're good things that we can have in our bag of tricks, our box of tools, as it were, and we draw them out when appropriate to make use of them to show the legitimacy of the kinds of things that we believe as Christians. I don't think we should be sacrificing some of these tools for the reasons that presuppositionalists say.
Right.
Does that help?
It does. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, good to talk to you from Baltimore. And that's the end of this hour, friends. Thank you for the call, Travis. But we have hour number two straight ahead. If you're leaving us, don't forget April 30th, Faith Under Fire, PAX TV, and 1 hour with Lee Strobel and Deepak Chopra and Mr. Kokel. Hope you tune in for that. And I hope you stay tuned for our next hour. We got callers coming up, 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Like to talk with you in hour number two. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research?
Listen, where do you get this nonsense?
Stand to reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host. Hour number two here. This is the School of Clear Thinking Christianity. In our 16th year with KBRT here in Southern California, glad for the partnership, by the way. I did about 7 years with them, Saturday and Sunday drive time, 3 hours each day. Boy, Sunday night I was worn out because I had a regular job, too, during the week, and I often was teaching on Sunday mornings or Saturday nights, so I was doing a lot there. Glad to be here, and you can get in on the discussion, 1-800-227-5278, or if you're in the 714 area code, the number 754-4150, local. Case for Creator is a conference coming up in 2 weeks. It's with Lee Strobel. He has written a book by that title, and following his style, he interviews people that are in the know on the issue that he's researching. His question was the universe intelligently designed, and the answer is yes, from his perspective, based on his interviews with some of the leading minds in the area. These minds will be here in Southern California for a conference 2 weeks from this weekend, May 6th and May 7th. Let's see. The conference speakers are J.P. Moreland, author of Body and Soul, Jonathan Wells, author of Icons of Evolution, and Dr. Jay Richards, author of The Privileged Planet. You can see all of them and Lee Strobel at the Case for a Creator, May 6th and 7th. Let's see. It's at Capistrano Valley Church and Christian School. Capistrano, you know, San Juan Capistrano, where the swallows come, that's where it's going to be. And Sean McDowell is one of the hosts for this. I think Sean will be emceeing as well. And Stand to Reason will have a table there. We just want you to know it's there, and it's going to be, I think, a good event. Go to our website at str.org, str.org. And Melinda, do we have a link there to their website? Yeah, we do. So just the simplest thing, just go to our website. There is a charge for, I think it is $15 for Friday night alone. Saturday is $30. Student rate with a valid student ID is $25. Doesn't matter. It's worth the money to see Lee Strobel, J.P. Moreland, Jonathan Wells, and Jay Richards all live in an interactive environment dealing with the issue of the Case for a Creator. These guys are all sharp. We've had them all on our show at one time or another, and that'll be a lot of fun. So I hope you can make it. Go to our website, str.org, and then click through to the link. There's a PDF form there for them to fill out. Okay, good. We have a link there for you can download a PDF form and fill that out and register for the Case for a Creator in San Juan Capistrano May 6th and 7th. All right. I did a lot of talking last hour. Let's go quickly to callers. And Matthew, welcome to Stand to Reason. Matthew, you're on the air, I think. Matt, are you there? I hear you in the background, Matt. Are you waiting for the radio to catch up with you? Matthew wants to talk about William Lane Craig and inclusivism. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, there you go. Matt, welcome to the show. I was just about to put you on hold again.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, what's up?
First of all, I wanted to say you're doing a great job. I'm so happy in your 16th year because your organization does so good work.
Thank you. Thanks.
I want to talk to you is the issue that you raised in the last hour.
Yeah.
Roman Catholic and differences about inclusivism and exclusivism and so about their soteriological views and who can be saved and so forth.
Right. Uh-huh.
I think you might have mischaracterized or misunderstood their view. Let me just preface my remark. I'm just beginning my studies of the difference between Catholics and Protestants, so it might be off. But I think even in J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig, in their book, Philosophical Foundations of a Christian Worldview,
right.
They defend a version of accessibilism consistent with Christian particularism that seems in line with what Roman Catholics argue. And, William Lane Craig, I'll just read the paragraph for you. They say, the offer of Romans 2, to those who patiently doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality, he will give eternal life.
Right.
Bona fide offer to salvation. This is not to say that people can be saved apart from Christ. Rather, it is to say that the benefits of Christ's atoning death can be applied to people without their conscious knowledge of Christ. Such persons would be similar to certain figures mentioned in the Old Testament, like Job and Melchizedek, who had no conscious knowledge of Christ and were not even members of the covenant family of Israel, and yet clearly enjoyed a personal relationship with God.
Right, okay.
Similarly, these could modern-day Jobs, living among the percentage of the world population that have not heard the gospel, could be saved. Now,
yes.
Later on admit, of course, the Bible's testimony is that the people who meet even this minimal standard of general revelation is low. It's low, and so forth. They qualify the remark.
Right, right. Okay, I'm with you on here, and I think that there's a kinship between that carefully crafted statement and a careful rendering of the Roman Catholic view of inclusivism.
Right.
But let me point out some differences here that are important because I know both of these men, Bill Craig and J.P. Moreland, quite well.
Okay.
And Bill does not believe that you can follow another religion and still be saved. That is, you can't be saved through being a Muslim and just deceived by accident. You're doing the best you can, and Roman Catholic inclusivism does hold that's the case.
Okay.
Or Judaism or Hinduism or Islam, whatever it happens to me, they do hold that, and Bill doesn't.
Okay, I think that last statement is the one where you and I would disagree on because I would have to verify that because I just got some of the right.
You mean with regards to Bill Craig and JP or with regards to Roman Catholics?
With respect to Roman Catholics.
Okay, well, here's where I get my information. When I'm on the air
right.
with Roman Catholic spokespersons
right, right.
who are speaking for the Los Angeles Diocese as bona fide representatives of Roman Catholicism
right.
who oppose me publicly on the air for declaring that Jews need to put their faith in Jesus Christ as Messiah, and they say, no, the Jews do not need to believe in Jesus. They have their own covenant.
Right, right.
And not only did I get this from every single Roman Catholic priest that I've ever been on the air with, and that probably is close to 10 different ones who are speaking in an official capacity for the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay.
But one of them actually studied ecumenism in the Vatican, and I had him on my radio show discussing this, and he held the same thing. In fact, when I asked him, name a false religion for me,
he
said atheism and what was the other? Two A's. Atheism and
agnosticism.
No, because they're not really religions, but he said atheism and something else, but it was like way off the charts. He could not bring himself to condemn any recognizable religion as a false religion because of his commitment to inclusivism of Vatican II.
Right. Okay. I find myself in the awkward position being a Protestant
defending Roman Catholics on this, right?
Yeah. Because I think I agree with you. I would not take the views of Mother Teresa as a saint, great woman, but I would not take her views about not proselytizing to Hindus as being authoritative
right.
of the cure. I would recommend that you probably read, actually the writings of Ratzinger himself.
Okay. Now, if Ratzinger doesn't believe this, then I'm glad, all right? But keep in mind here, we are talking about a church that has a very a well-defined authority structure and makes a very specific and precise kind of authority claim. They're not Protestants where there's a lot of latitude to reinterpret the Bible or interpret it from your own perspective.
Right.
This is what they say is so. So why is it that if you want to get the real, true Roman Catholic view, you can't talk to Roman Catholic priests or leaders of the church or bishops, one of the people that I was in this debate with on the air on Religion on the Line with Dennis Prager, was actually a bishop, Bishop Blair. Why can't I trust doctrine from the – I've got to go to these rarefied sources for the one guy that got it right. This is the Roman Catholic Church after all.
You know, I don't know. I'm not an authority on Roman Catholicism, but my study of it from Alistair McGrath, his book on the origins of the Reformation, their authority claim, the relationship between sola scriptura and their authority claim between that and the tradition is rather nuanced. And it's far more complicated than the way that you described it. McGrath, he himself is Reformed. A chapter on that. So I'm just beginning. So I can't give a definite.
Okay. Well, fair enough. You know, I know that there are a number of things that you could say. Here's what Roman Catholics believe. But when you get down to the hardcore, nitty-gritty authority in Rome, in the back room, they're going to say, look, we've been very careful to nuance it this way.
Right.
Okay, but in some senses, that is a bit inconsequential, and I'll tell you why here, Matthew.
Okay.
Because a couple of Roman Catholic clerics in the ivory tower can nuance it in a way that doesn't create problems,
right,
doesn't mean we don't have a problem with Roman Catholicism writ large. If all of the priests believe and teach something different so that the faithful have a whole different idea, then what is the Roman Catholic doctrine? What a few clerics believe who say we got the real thing here in the Vatican, or everybody else, the millions upon billions, who are reading their things from the catechism and being taught by the priests?
No, I agree with you. That's a problem with like the teaching, the way that Roman Catholics teach to the laity. I agree with that. But I just want to say, like, you know, John Paul II, even though he's widely known as the correct way of being an ecumenist, he never denied, for example, that Catholicism had the true faith, or it was the path to Christ. And I would see
Sure, I'm sure that he held that.
Oh, I'm sorry about Go. Islam, because you know, in Islam, from its very genesis, actually had to repudiate the knowledge of Christ because they claim Christ was merely a prophet. So
merely a prophet. He also didn't die on the cross, and he didn't raise from the dead.
Exactly. So I would be hard pressed about that. But I'm talking If Vatican II holds the nuanced position that Craig and Moreland proposed, I think it's quite defensible.
Well, there always was, even when I was a kid, I remember, a thing called the baptism of desire.
Right.
That is, under certain circumstances, a person out in the far reaches who didn't know anything but did his best to seek after the true God had the baptism of desire and would be welcomed into the church from God's perspective. But Vatican II has taken this ancient baptism of desire, which might be a way of characterizing Bill Craig's and J.P. Moreland's very carefully crafted, nuanced position.
Right.
They have taken that concept of baptism of desire and blown it beyond recognition in the application here in the new era, so that the good Buddhist, the good Hindu, the good sincere Muslim, and Christ-rejecting Jew would still be saved by the blood of Christ, and this makes mockery of the gospel, it seems to me.
No, I totally agree with you.
Okay.
I think we're in agreement there. I just have one question. I promise, not about this. It's really quick. Last week, some guy called, I forgot his name, about you know, the Bible is mistaken in certain things and meant certain codexes that you had to go. What would be a good resource in all that kind of stuff?
Well, if you mean about the textual criticism of the Bible, the things that I'm aware of are too tedious. Okay, here's the best. I just thought of one. It's written by Geisler and Nix, N-I-X, Norm Geisler and Nix, and it's called The General Introduction to the Bible.
Okay.
The General Introduction to the Bible, and you could also maybe check out F.F. Bruce's book on the canon.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And so those are two sources that would help out a lot, I think. All the rest of them are too, you know, too particular, and they're academic kind of works and wouldn't interest you probably. All right?
Thanks a lot.
It's good talking to you, Matthew. Thank you. Bye-bye. You know, on this issue, and I appreciate Matthew's citation of Bill Craig and J.P. Moreland on this thing, I I guess I would say that I am, in a sense, theoretically open to the option that Bill Craig and JP have offered. That is, it's possible there can be someone in the world that is not directly associated with the gospel that ends up being saved. Now, it's easy to cite Job and some of those others, but I think it's fair also to say that we're in a different economy and maybe the rules are different now. Because now the revelation is in Jesus when there was no revelation of Jesus in the past. There was a way in which people could express their trust in God's provision in the Old Testament system, where in the New Testament system there is only one way of expressing that trust, and that is through the person of Jesus. So I acknowledge that happened in the Old Testament. In the New Testament times, though, it seems like the testimony is quite clear. And the question then is, well, what about that poor person in New Testament times who is genuinely seeking the true God? And my response is, either there is no such person, or if there is, he is only genuinely seeking the true God because the true God has already begun to draw him to himself in a unique way. Now, I can say there is no such person because it seems that Paul makes it very clear in Romans 1, 2, and 3 that people are in a standard stance of rebellion against God, and even when God shows himself clearly, they run the other way. And they do so aggressively. He says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. It is because of their unrighteous rebellion that they don't even look at the truth that's been given to them, and this is why they're without excuse. So I don't know that there is such a person like that. Well, then how does somebody get saved? The only way they get saved is for God to do some kind of work in their lives. Now, whether you're Arminian or Calvinist, you've got to believe this because the Bible says it. How much of that work that God does to turn someone's head is the difference between Calvinists and Arminians, but we all agree that God has to work. Now, here's my conclusion from the fact that men are running from God and not pursuing God at all. God must somehow, in some way, intervene to begin turning them. If God's standard for salvation is Jesus, and he is already intervening to turn someone to the truth, why would God withhold the message necessary for their salvation from these people he's already drawing? The point I'm making is God isn't just going to do a halfway job. He is going to give that message to them, and there are many stories of missionaries who have remarkable circumstances, and I don't have time to go into them now, but Eternity in Their Hearts by Don Richardson has some of the stories where God has moved heaven and earth to get a message to someone genuinely seeking. We see in the book of Acts Cornelius, the Ethiopian eunuch, for goodness sake, these are good examples of God bringing the message that is necessary to these people. So it's not my conviction that God is just going to let these people waste away because they're just of a geographical accident. They didn't happen to be in the right country to get the message. I think if these people are seeking the way others are suggesting, then it is entirely expected that God would give the message that God himself has ordained for their salvation. God's not restricted in this way. Now, if that's true, then when you think about Vatican II, about those who through no fault of their own have been separated from the gospel and sincerely pursue God the way they know how, this doesn't apply at all. Because there is no one through no fault of their own who have been separated. Paul says they all are at fault because they all rebel. They are without excuse. They have enough to know. If they are turning, it's because God is working in their heart. If they are genuinely sincere, God sees that, and he doesn't rescue them based on their sincere pursuit of a false religion. No, God acts to give them the truth. He's not constrained to get through borders. He's not constrained to communicate to people in distant places. There's no problem there. If that person is genuinely seeking, if the New Testament teaches that this is the message that saves, then God will get him the message. And some will say, yes, but what about all these people that the message hasn't gone to? Well, I've got to conclude, since if they're really genuinely seeking, that God wants them to have the message and he's capable of giving the message, but he's not getting the message to those people in there, then there is nobody that's really genuinely seeking in those, sir. Are you trying to tell me that they don't really know? How do you know? Because Paul said so. under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit in Romans chapter 1 and 2 and 3. Yes, for those who seek after God, immortality and eternal life will be given that. But in chapter 3, he says, nobody does that. There is none righteous, not even one. There is none who seeks after God. So our understanding of his comment in Romans chapter 2, that to those that God will render to every man according to his deeds, verse 6, verse 7, to those who by perseverance in doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality, they'll get eternal life. Fine, God will render that. But what do people actually do? Paul tells us. Chapter 3, there is none who seeks for God. Chapter 3, verse 11. Nobody satisfies this requirement identified in chapter 2. That's what it seems to me. And if they do turn, it is only because God has already done something in their lives. And if God is working in their lives to draw them to him, then he will give them whatever message they need to understand Jesus and put their faith in the New Testament message in Jesus Christ himself and be saved. It's as simple as that. 1-800-227-5278, Greg Kokol. More to come after this.
How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005, for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokol will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
You broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down.
I always thought this is a fun song until I listened to the words. And then I thought it was incredibly shallow. Do you love me now that I can dance? Who would want a girlfriend that only loved you because you could dance? I can really let it happen now. Watch me, baby. But it is a lot of fun, I gotta admit there. Greg Kokol, Stand to Reason. Hey, we just had the spot about our cruise. And of course, we've been talking about our cruise for a number of months now. That's coming up in August, and August 7th for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. I just want to extend a personal invitation. If you've been thinking about this, come on board. Join us for a vacation. We'll have a week together with Stand to Reason and you and J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig and Craig Hazen, all part of the one big happy family, learning, talking, enjoying things together, traveling together, seeing things. You'll see my wife will be there with my baby. You can meet my baby girl. I mean, what could be better? Fantastic time. So if you've been thinking about doing this, now's the time to make your plans, because we have been allotted a certain number of rooms set aside for our group. And as time goes on, they begin releasing those cabins to other groups. So now's the time to go to our website, str.org, and check on our Alaskan cruise and go right through there, and we'll connect you to Inspiration Cruises and Tours. Or you can dial up 1-800-247-1899. That's 800-247-1899 for Inspiration Cruises and Tours. And go ahead and book your vacation with JP, Bill Craig, Craig Hazen, and myself on our Alaskan cruise August 7th this summer. Hope to see you there. Let's see. Could you remove the little cruise tab so I can see the rest of that one? There it is. And that would be David. David, welcome to Stand to Reason.
How are you, Greg?
I'm doing fine.
God bless you.
Thank you. What's up? What's on your mind? Okay.
I think in some fashion I want to agree with you for a change.
Well, thank you. What did I do right this time?
Well, you know, your conversations here recently, you know, with respect to what I consider a very pagan religion, which is Catholicism. I mean, I think in some fashion, you know, it doesn't help to mince words with respect to calling out a number of the falsehoods, not only of the Catholic Church, but of course the Protestant Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one to believe that I guess it's Calvinism in a sense, in that we are all called out. God calls us out specifically at certain times.
When you say we are all called out, do you mean all Christians are called by God, or
no,
all people
not at
are
all.
Called
As
by God?
As a matter of fact, I think again, you bring up Paul in Romans, you know, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11 is always a good one that sticks in my mind.
And what does that say?
What it says specifically is that God will send people a strong delusion that they'll believe in.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so the reason I asked is you said, I guess this is Calvinism, and then it sounded like you said that God calls everyone. And Calvinism isn't that God calls everyone, but rather that God calls the elect. And I was
correct.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm trying to...
That's all right. I'm not trying to embarrass you or correct you. I just wasn't sure.
You're not. Okay. I just want to make that point very clear. I believe personally that God only calls certain people.
Mm-hmm.
You have basically the 7,000 that will be called out. You have the 144,000 Jews that will be called out, and as I've been taught, you have the whomsoever will be.
Well, there's two aspects of the call. There is the invitation, and that's called the call, and that is an invitation that goes out to everyone.
Correct.
But not everybody responds because of their rebellion against God. And so then there are also the called, and that is the group that responds, and they respond by God's grace to this message. And so there are those that are called, which is everyone, and then there's another group called the called, which are only the ones that respond. And so the word is used in two different ways.
Correct.
And it's important to keep them distinct.
I think people have after you know, learning and studying a little bit of this, I think people have a vain belief in the church, in the sense that the word church in the Greek is ecclesia.
Yeah, ecclesia, the called out
ecclesia.
Ones, right?
Exactly, and
the gathering. And, yes, uh huh.
Correct, and I think that in other words, people that go to these churches that are filled with this paganistic, ritualistic tradition of men.
You're speaking of the Roman Catholic Church.
No, I'm speaking of a lot of.
Okay.
Keep in mind, there's only two churches that are going to be called up: Philadelphia and Smyrna.
Oh, you're referring to those referred to in the Book of Revelation. Are you saying that these are symbolically characterizations of certain types of beliefs, Smyrna and Philadelphia? Okay.
Well, I'm saying that all churches are. As we know, I'll give you an example. Mary worship, for example, is not just something that is unique to the Catholic Church. Many religions, Buddha, Hinduism, the Babylonian religion,
mm-hmm.
All had a mother and child figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do know in the Old Testament there was a Queen of Heaven, you know, that was worshipped by some of the groups around the Canaan, and of course this was condemned. And though the Roman Catholics would be quick to point out that they don't worship Mary. To be honest with you, when I look at the behavior, it's hard for me to distinguish worship from what, you know, the homage, that the appropriate kind of homage they say they're paying her. You know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, etc., maybe it is a duck. It seems to me that this has gone way overboard and is an example of the kind of thing that was even condemned in the Old Testament. David, I got to move on. I thank you for your call. Let's go. Is that Allie? Allie? Welcome to the show, Allie.
Ali.
My apologies, John. Ali.
A few weeks ago, you were talking about, I forgot the topic, but you said that Christ raised himself from the dead.
Yes, I did say that.
Okay, I see a number of scriptures that say that God raised him from the dead.
Yeah, they say that as well. Do you have a Bible in front of you?
I got my computer screen open.
Okay, go to the Gospel of John chapter 2.
Okay.
The Gospel of John chapter 2.
John 2, okay.
You're there. Scroll down to verse 19, or say 18. This is the case where Jesus cleanses the temple and stopped making my father's house a house of merchandise, verse 16. Verse 17, the disciples remembered it was written that zeal for thy house will consume me. Verse 18, the Jews therefore answered and said to him, what sign do you show us, seeing that you do these things? And Jesus answered and said to them, and read to me what it says.
Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.
Okay, first person singular, right?
Okay.
Okay, verse 20, the Jews therefore said it took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? Verse 21, what does it say?
But he spake of the temple of his body.
Therefore, he was talking about raising his body.
Okay.
Who does he say would raise his body?
He said, I will raise it up.
Okay, so there's a verse that... Okay.
Can I give you one?
Wait. Okay. Wait. Don't run so quickly away.
Okay.
One scripture says... Wait. This is very important.
Okay.
One scripture says unequivocally that Jesus would raise himself from the dead. Now, I know you're going to go to other verses, maybe Acts 2:24. I have it in my margin here, where it says, and God raised him up, right?
Well, how about other?
Acts 2:24 says that, and other passages do as well. I mean, I'm not going to dispute that with you, that the Scripture says God raised him up, but I want you to think about this for a moment. If the Scriptures say that God raised Jesus up, and Jesus says, I will raise myself up, what is the most reasonable thing to conclude from the convergence of those two claims? Maybe that Jesus was who?
Was God.
Hey, there you go.
Okay.
That's different, isn't it?
Right.
Well, that's my point. I think Jesus was God. And so that even though his human...
I totally agree to that.
Okay, well then, so even though his human nature was dead, deceased... His divine nature was still living to be able to raise his human body back to life. And so the scripture can say God raised Jesus because God did raise the body of Jesus. And Jesus could say, I will raise myself because he is also God who raised his physical body from the grave. There's no contradiction there at all.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
I understand that. I understand that thoroughly.
Okay.
Let me give you Ephesians 1:20.
Okay. Now, are you going to argue contrary to my point that I just made?
Because
it sounds like we agree. So why are we continuing looking at other verses?
Let's just read Ephesians 1:20.
Okay.
And then go work through that.
Okay. For which he brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead. He, the Father, raised Jesus from the dead.
Right.
Fine. Seated him at the right hand of the... We both agree about this.
His own right hand.
We both agree on this.
Okay.
God doesn't have a hand, by the way. So he's not sitting at the right side of his body. That's a figure of speech. But in any event, the point is, here's another verse that says, like the verse that I quoted from Acts 2, that God raised him from the dead. Okay, so what's the – I'm not sure what –
well,
we agree on this.
There's two – we know that the Son is – the Father is greater than the Son.
Well,
and that
has to be qualified.
Right hand, figuratively.
We have to qualify when we say that he's greater than the Son.
But the Son said he was. My Father is greater than I.
That's right, because Jesus was a man, and so therefore any divine being is greater. The God is greater than a human being. But Jesus was also God, and this is what you have to keep in mind. Jesus also got tired. Do you think that was his divine nature, or is that his physical nature he's referring to?
Well, he emptied himself of his divine power and nature.
Yeah.
Took upon himself the form of Adam.
Okay, when you say he emptied himself, do you mean he gave up his divinity, or he set aside his privileges of divinity?
Well, I don't know.
Distinction is very important, because the first one's a heresy and the second one isn't. If you say that Jesus got rid of his divinity, then Jesus is no longer God, and that's a problem. If you say that he simply laid aside his prerogatives of deity, there in Philippians 2, it talks about that, and then you're fine. But that doesn't create any problem for what we're discussing here. I think we should be agreeing on this.
Well,
Ali.
I think we agree. Okay, let me. I got a number of scriptures here.
Well, wait a minute. You can give me one more. But if you give me another one like the one you just gave me, then we're not moving forward in this, because all you're saying is God raised him from the dead, which I agree with.
But
also that Jesus said that he raised himself from the dead, which you have to agree with, because that's what Jesus said in John chapter 2, which concludes that Jesus is God, which we both agree with anyway. So I don't know where we're going with this.
Okay. I guess you're saying that God, that there is no separation between the Father and the Son.
Well, there is no
it depends
what you mean by that, but yeah, there is a difference between them, but there's no separation. They share the same essence, though they are different persons.
Well, it's
that's orthodoxy.
Okay.
I'm trying to be as precise as I can.
Why did Christ on the cross say, you know, what he said,
my God, why did I forsake me? That's because he was quoting Psalm 22. Go back to Psalm 22.
He wasn't just quoting Psalms.
Yeah. No, he wasn't just quoting. He was experiencing what he was being experienced in Psalm 22. And when you read Psalm 22, you realize that the person in this agony is saying this statement because he's not being rescued from this, from what he's experiencing. Far from my deliverance are the sounds of my groaning, is what he says in the next verse. And that explains it. He's saying, I'm miserable here, as an understatement, and you're not rescuing me. That's what the statement means. And, of course, he's got to go through the entire time of the cross. Now, if we are going to try to suggest that, well, that's when there was a division in the nature of God, well, that's nonsense, because that never happened and the Bible doesn't teach it. You're reading something into that statement that can't be the case, because if Jesus can't cease being God, because that's part of his nature.
Okay, I guess one of the difficulties we have between your understanding and mine is, what is death? When Christ died and he was dead for 3 days and three nights,
his physical body was not functioning. It was not alive in any sense. It was gone.
Where was his spirit?
Pardon me?
Where was his spirit?
I don't know. The Bible doesn't say.
He says, Father, receive my spirit, when he died.
Okay.
So, you know, I think it's a matter of definitions of death or of the spirit.
Yeah,
what happens to us when we die? I die, my body is dead, but I can't raise myself.
Ali, I've got to move on to another caller here. But look, it looks like on all the essential things we agree with, you're focusing on something that strikes me as not to be that relevant, and that is what happens to our spirit when we die, and that's somehow relevant to the question of who raised Jesus from the dead. It may be relevant to the kind of being Jesus is, but we already know that. We know that he is one person with two natures, the divine nature and the human nature. The human nature was deceased at the cross, and the divine nature still existed and was alive. And so Jesus, the God-man, could raise his human nature from the dead, no problem. It doesn't matter where he was at, whether he's at the right hand of the Father or the left hand of the Father, or in the grave or down in the earth or up in heaven, or that's not relevant to the question that we're asking here. And so I don't want you to strain at gnats and swallow camels here, okay? It's good talking to you, though. I'm glad you brought it up. It gave us a chance to chat a little bit about something important. I've got to go to break. 1-800-227-5278. Lines open here in our final segment on Stand to Reason.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Goodbye, Joe. He gotta go. He'll mind.
Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, next Saturday night, April 30th, Faith Under Fire with Lee Strobel, his guest Deepak Chopra, and yours truly for the whole hour. I think it's going to be an interesting interchange. I've only seen a clip of it, maybe 16 minutes or 13 minutes. The rest of my staff have seen the entire show. I've just seen that clip that we showed to our audiences a couple of weeks ago, that when we had our own special event with Hugh Hewitt, and it was kind of fun watching it. As I mentioned at the time, it was more fun watching it than it was doing it originally, but I hope you enjoy it. I hope you get a chance to see it. There might be some things that you'll learn from that occasion about maneuvering and circumstances like that, but I hope that you'll also pray that it has a profound impact on those watching it. I had a boyhood chum of 40-some years, let's see, 50, yeah, I would say about 45, almost, well, more than 40 years ago, a boyhood chum from way back who actually called me, having seen me on the first episode I did with them last season on Faith Under Fire, and was favorably impressed, and it kind of renewed a friendship. He's not a believer, but it's given me an opportunity to talk about some spiritual things with him, and he's all excited about seeing the evening, April 30th, when Faith Under Fire is aired, the one with Deepak Chopra. And so you never know what God's going to do with these things. So please pray that there is a powerful spiritual impact as hopefully a voice of reason and grace, Stand to Reason here in this particular case, speaking against the number one New Age guru in the world, Deepak Chopra, who, I mean this in the most Christian way possible, spews nothing but nonsense to a world who follows him and laps at his heels because they think it's so wonderful. And you will hear, you will hear some things that just strike, what struck me as just frankly incoherent. But it's bad news because it's spiritual poison, even though, as far as I could tell, Mr. Chopra is a nice man. I'm taking exception with his ideas. And so I invite you to watch next Saturday night, if you're in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, and you're watching PAX TV. Faith Under Fire is probably on at 10 at night. I don't know the station because I don't watch TV. We'll figure it out ourselves and watch it. But if you're in another part of the country, I don't know what time the show airs. You're going to have to go to the PAX website. Please don't call our office asking us when it's airing. It's airing April 30th, and you'll have to check your local markets, okay? That's Faith Under Fire, April 30th, Deepak Chopra, Greg Kokel, Lee Strobel. Hope you can view it. Okay, back to the phones. And Janice?
Hello?
Hello, Janice.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
How are you?
I have kind of a basic question here. If I'm talking to somebody about Christianity, and they come up, they'll say, do you know who Dennis Prager is? Yes, I do. What do you think about him? Oh, he's a great person and so forth. Is he going to hell? Well, no, don't tell me well. Tell me yes or no. Is he or isn't he? And if I say yes, that's it. It's all over. Close subject. Go away. I don't want to hear anymore.
Okay.
What do you do then?
Okay, I'll tell you what I told Dennis when that issue came up for me on the air when I was with him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think this is a case where we have to try to maneuver just a little bit. And we want to maneuver not because we don't want to say what we really think.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we want to maneuver just a little bit is because we want people to understand what we mean when we say what we say. All right? So I might, depending on the nature of the question, I might ask another question first, not to buy time, but to lay the groundwork a little bit. And the question I might ask for the person who asked me this, do you think that Dennis Prager is going to hell? I'm going to say, I'll answer your question, but I'm not going to avoid it, but I want to ask you another question first. And here's my question. Do you think that people who do bad things should pay for the bad things they do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, my suspicion is the person that I'm speaking to will say, yes, I do believe they should pay for the bad thing. I'm not sure. I mean, but I'm counting on them saying, yeah, I think they should pay. And my response is, I agree with you. So if Dennis Prager has ever done any bad things, then God will hold him accountable for those things. And whatever sins he committed, he will have to pay for. Now, what is the way that God exacts punishment for sins committed against him in the afterlife?
Mm-hmm.
What is that way?
Going to hell.
That's right. So anybody who breaks God's law will be punished by God in the place where God punishes people. Okay? And that is hell. And when Dennis asked me the very same question on his program on Religion in the Line a number of years ago, I said this first. I said, Dennis, just I want everybody to understand where I'm coming from with this answer. I think you are a better man than I will ever be. And I said that very genuinely, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Dennis, and I think that's true. I think he is a better man than I will ever be. He's exceedingly gracious. He's kind. He's genuine. He's winsome. He's attractive. He's virtuous in many, many ways, in ways that I don't think I will ever approximate. However, I said, even though I think you're a better man than me, you will not get into heaven given the way you understand how this all works. I will, because even though I'm a bigger sinner than you, my sins are being forgiven according to the way that God has ordained, and you have refused that forgiveness and want to stand. I quite literally is true. You want to stand before God based on your own merit. When you go based on your merit, God will judge you for the crimes against him that you've committed, whatever they are. If it's your sins, such as they are, you will have to pay for, unless you let Jesus pay for them. So the short answer to this blunt question, do you think that Dennis Prager is going to hell? My answer is, sadly, yes. But the reason why is not because I'm a better man than he is, because I don't think I am. I think he's a better man than I am. The reason why is that being a better man doesn't cut it. We both have crimes before God that require forgiveness, and if we haven't received the forgiveness God offers through the means that God offers, which is his son Jesus, then we will have to pay for our crimes ourselves. Do you see how the answer is the same, but I've kind of nuanced it a bit so you can see the reason why I hold the view that I hold?
Right.
Okay, and that to me is important, and a lot of times people don't give me a chance to explain that.
I don't get the chance. And then the next thing is, you mean he's going to be in the same place as Hitler?
Well, the answer is, broadly speaking, yes. It's kind of like when you think of prison. You go to prison,
mm-hmm.
so you're a white-collar criminal, yes, and you're going to prison, right? You're going to the same place as Charles Manson? Well, I'm going, in general, to prison, and he's in prison, but he may be in solitary confinement, and I might be in a work farm. So I don't get exactly the same as Hitler. And see, this is part of the misunderstanding. People think that hell is just one place where everybody gets poured into, and it's all the same for everybody.
Right.
And so even the best person gets the same punishment as the worst person, and that's not true. the Bible teaches very clearly that there are greater punishments for greater sinners and lesser punishments for lesser sinners. And just like there are greater rewards for some people in heaven and lesser rewards for others, then the same thing in hell. And so it is the punishment is different for different people, but the duration is the same, banishment forever from a God against whom sinners have rebelled.
What did
does that make sense, by the way?
Yes, it does. Okay. If you can get that far.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. So,
if you want,
here, if you want a one sentence thing, here's what I would say.
No, they want a one word answer.
I can't answer it. It would not be fair to give you one word. I can give you one sentence. Mm-hmm. Because if I gave you, do you want my accurate answer?
Right.
Yes, you do. Okay, then one word will not give you the accurate answer. It will mislead you.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you a sentence. If you don't have any more time than a sentence, I think that Dennis Prager will – I mean, to use Dennis as an example, obviously you raised his name. I wouldn't because I have great admiration for him. But Mother Teresa, actually some people said – I mean, this issue, Mother Teresa came up on Religion on the Line too. What about Mother Teresa? Mother Teresa, apart from Christ, okay – and I'm not saying she wasn't a Christian. I'm just saying in principle, in theory, apart from Christ, she would have to pay for her crimes against God such as they are. You will have to pay. I will have to pay. Everyone will have to pay for our crimes before God such as they are. If you got very few crimes, you pay for few crimes. If you have big crimes, you pay for big crimes. Now, what's the exception to that? Those who have received the mercy that God offers through Jesus. If you receive a pardon, then you don't pay for your crimes. Whether they're big or whether they're small, it doesn't matter. You don't pay for your crimes.
What did Dennis Prager say when you said that?
Well, I'm trying to remember what his exact response was. He said, well, on your view, even if I stole a pencil, I would go to hell. And I said, well, yeah, and I think I can defend that. But the fact is, Dennis, you haven't just stolen a pencil. I mean, every single person commits many sins every single day. And if you think of Jesus' comment that you are to love your Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, and soul, and you are to love your neighbor as yourself, if you just diminish the law or reduce it to simply those two principles, nobody ever fulfills those, even for a split second, it seems to me. Certainly I don't. Mm-hmm. So we are always in violation of the two greatest commandments. I mean, maybe there are some that are completely selfless or whatever, and so I'd be willing to grant that, but it's not very many people are like that. The fact is, when Jesus identified the greatest commandments, he didn't make the job simpler. He made it more difficult.
Right.
That was the way that he responded to me, though, something along that line.
In view of all that, it's amazing how he is so pro-Christian.
Yeah, but he's pro-Christian because of a worldview issue,
yes.
Not because he agrees with our view about of salvation. And in fact, he made a comment last week. I heard him speaking of Pope John Paul. He said there was hardly anything that I agreed with John Paul on, but I respected him as a man, and he is roughly in the same worldview camp. He's a theist. He believes in God. He believes in morality. He's not a relativist, and he believes that ethical conduct matters. And so even though he is broadly speaking, pro-abortion, where the Pope wasn't. He's pro-capital punishment. The Pope is not. He is broadly inclusivistic, where the Pope may be a little more narrow, whatever. Though he disagrees in these things, he still finds himself very kin to the Pope in worldview issues, and I find myself as well kin to both of them. Mm-hmm. And this is why I said I was happy with the choice of Benedict, actually Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now Benedict the 16th, because I think that he will be a conservative pope championing the kind of worldview that I believe in, even though we have some theological differences.
Yeah, right. It's amazing how many Catholics that are anti him are hoping he's a transitional pope and won't last very long.
Well, then that's because they don't really believe in Catholicism, it seems to me. Anyway, Janice, got to go. Thank you for your call. I wanted to catch Ed here before the end of the show. Ed, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hallelujah. Boy, this is anticlimactic. And
glory.
I thought it was going to be.
Oh, sounds like a Pentecostal. What's on your mind today here, Ed?
First of all, I want to thank you for a little something that you gave out last Sunday, which is faith is a preponderance to act as if what you believe is true.
Yes, yes. It's a disposition to act as though the thing that you believe is actually so. That's right. That's what belief is, acting as if the thing is so. And if you're not acting if it's so, it's not reasonable to say that you have faith in it or that you believe it. Well, I'm glad you like that, Ed. Thanks. We're tight here for time, so what's on your mind?
Because I was having a discussion in a group at church having to do with Christians and feelings.
Yeah.
And everybody I was having this discussion with stated that as Christians we can't depend on, or even for that matter of fact, that we should discount our feelings and our emotions in our daily Christian living.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that feelings are fine. They're wonderful. I wish I had more of them, to be honest with you, in certain circumstances. The problem that they are getting at is not that there's anything wrong with feelings, but that feelings are not an adequate guide to what's true. We can have all kinds of feelings, likes and dislikes, about things that may be false or that may be wrong. Feelings are not the proper guide to what's right and wrong and to what's true and false. I think feelings make life enjoyable, and facts or reason or careful thinking makes life safe. All right? We want both.
Right.
Not either or. We want both. And if I had to do either or, frankly, I'd rather go with the facts. I'd rather know what is true, even if I felt badly about it, than to feel great about a lie.
Well, my point, Greg, was that you can't really divide it. You can't set feelings, emotions aside when we deal with everyday facts, can you?
Well, no, they're a part of the human condition, and they always enter in some way. But when if you were a judge, had to judge a case, and it turned out that the person that coming before you was actually a close relative, you would probably be right to recuse yourself, because you'd realize that because you have a personal stake in the matter, that is, you have personal feelings, it's possible that your feelings are going to distort your judgment. And this is the issue. These are feelings, and facts are part of every circumstance, but when facts are paramount in a given situation and feelings are strong enough to distort the facts, that's when we have to work very hard to get the feelings out of the way so that we make the right judgments. That's basically what I'm saying.
So that our human condition influences our feelings.
Well, a lot of things influence our feelings, but we want to make sure that the feelings are not influencing our facts.
Okay.
Or the reasons of making the decisions that we have, when the decisions are weighty decisions. That's basically what I'm saying. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. It was a great show for me. I enjoyed myself. Hope you did too. And I'll be back next week, same time, same place, for another 2 hours. The enforcers thought that was funny. Another 2 hours together. In the meantime, be a good ambassador. Don't forget to watch Faith Under Fire next Saturday night on the 30th. Lee Strobel, Deepak Chopra, and yours truly, battling it out for 1 hour, all devoted to that debate. Saturday night, Faith Under Fire, PAX TV. Check your local listings. In the meantime, we'll see you next week, friends, and give them heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.